Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 355 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyler, your host once again. Today we have another of our classic rewind series of episodes, and we're going to listen one more time to my good friend Mike Kim. Mike first appeared on the program way back on episode 281, which is what originally aired the end of August in 2021. And if you don't know Mike Kim, you should. He is one of the premier, if not, the guy for personal branding. And to the extent that our law practices, particularly for solo and small firm practitioners, are an extension of our personality and our personal brand, this is a guy that you want to pay attention to and listen to. He is the author, as you will hear, of the book, You Are the Brand. He also has a very, very popular podcast by the same name, available wherever you pick up podcasts such as this. And he's just one of the most coherent and, I think, logical thinkers when it comes to laying out the issues and the factors that have to be considered when working to develop your personal brand. And I gather a lot of information from Mike. He has one of the best newsletters, so you can subscribe to that. One of the most content-filled and actionable newsletters around. I can't say enough about the guy, so much so that I thought, hey, let's have him back on in the classic rewind, and maybe sometime soon we can have him again live and in person. So without any further delay, here once again is Mike Kim.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 281 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host as usual. And today my guest is my friend Mike Kim. Now, Mike is a brand strategist for business thought leaders and coaches and authors and the like who want to create impact with their ideas and get their message heard. He has been heard and seen on numerous places, PBS, TED, Talk, CNN, Fox, and what have you. But most recently, he's the author of a new book. And the book is called You Are the Brand, the 8-step blueprint to showcase your unique expertise and build a highly profitable, personally fulfilling business. And I wanted Mike to come on the program today because, you know, creating a brand is so difficult at times for attorneys, particularly for solo and small firm practitioners. We don't have a lot of money to spend on, you know, a brand advertising company. And so we kind of try and figure out on our own what our brand is or what our message is. And it's difficult unless you really know what you're doing. And there's a lot of, start and stops and, trial and error involved in creating a brand for your legal business, your law firm. So Mike is a perfect person to have on to talk about it. He's worked with attorneys in the past. In fact, I first met him at a legal event in New Orleans, as you will hear when we talk about that on the podcast. So without any further delay, here's my friend and author of the book, You Are the Brand, Mike Kim. Mike Kim, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
I am honored to be here. Thank you for having me, Neil. I hope to add some value to everybody today.
Well, I have no doubt about that, Mike. For our listeners, I've known Mike for quite some time. And actually, I was thinking about this. I probably should have asked you earlier. Mike and I met at Ernie Svensson's first law firm Autopilot Bootcamp down in New Orleans. And I'm trying to remember when that was.
Oh man, that must have been 2016.
Like I was going to say like five years ago. Anyway, we met there and then we've reconnected through another guest of ours and a good friend, Derek Coburn's group, Cadre DC, which our listeners have known and heard me speak about on many occasions. So I'm delighted to reintroduce or to introduce you to my audience and to reconnect with you, Mike. So by way of introduction, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, I am a marketing and brand strategist who specializes in working with experts, thought leaders, and influencers, basically people who share their ideas, their expertise, and build their business around their ideas, their expertise, their reputation, and their personality. Attorneys are an interesting group because your personality matters. You know, there's a lot that's going on, like in a prospect's psychology when they choose an attorney. And the funny thing is, you know, there are multiple times in my life I've had to find an attorney for various reasons. And the prospect is always wishing for you to be the one. They don't want to necessarily go a lot of window shopping, you know, because usually when they're calling an attorney, something's really urgent. Yeah. You know, Neil? And they, so
there's a crisis involved.
Yeah, there's a crisis. And my neck is bleeding. I need somebody, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot that I've worked. I really love working with people. I love the idea of marketing people and branding people. And attorneys are among my favorites. And that's why I spoke at Ernie's event and we met. And that's why I'm here.
Well, and I will also share that, you know, one of the real challenges because, you know, we're just awash with flipping attorneys sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, they're everywhere. One of the challenges that attorneys have, and particularly solo and small firm attorneys that our audience is largely made up of, is setting yourself apart and making yourself recognizable in that sea of competitors. And so branding, even if you don't label it as such, branding becomes everything for an attorney.
It absolutely does. Yeah.
In that kind of setting. You know, and I know that I want to state right off the top that one of the reasons I'm so thrilled to have you with us today is you are a recent new author of a book called You Are the Brand, which is on the bestseller list now. As we speak here, we're recording this in the end of July, right at the pretty much at the top of the list.
Yeah. I was very fortunate. We hit number 4 on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. I think we would have been top, except for the fact that Donald Trump had 3 books written about him that all came out in the same week.
So that stinks. It's a big week for him.
We're not gonna beat those books as much as I'd like to try. We can't take out half of America, you know, with my branding book, but we did pretty well. We hit the USA Today bestseller list. And, you know, in all honesty, I think it just really goes to show there is a huge interest in this topic. It is relevant to a lot of different industries, you know, attorneys for one. Financial advisors, chiropractors, other healthcare professionals, speakers and coaches like myself, of course. But when we talk about branding, you know, all things being equal, if we're all good at what we do, what makes us different? It's our personalities. It's our story. It's who we are. It's why, quote unquote, being the best, Neil, isn't always the best differentiator. You know?
And very often the client, in terms of the legal space, it's hard for them to tell who's the best and who's not. You know, so claiming that you're the best doesn't always, you know, win the argument. So one of the things that you mentioned in this book, and I will encourage our audience to check it out, is you come from the perspective of having the person try and put themselves in the shoes of the buyer, the shoes of the client, prospective client, to become the person they're trying to sell to. Why is that important? I mean, it seems intuitive, but you've got some unique insights, I believe.
Yeah, you know, this personal brand space is very interesting because over the last, especially last 3 or 4 years with Instagram and YouTube becoming the main channels by which people communicate on social media, it's so much more visual. And there are two camps of people, I find. On one hand, there are folks who are presenting a false version of themselves. And like an extreme example is like to go out and rent a mansion on Airbnb and stage a photo shoot and sort of imply that it's their house and that they're super successful, right? And these folks don't realize that attention is not owed to them. You have to earn it. You have to earn the attention that you gain, right? On the flip side, you have folks who are using social media and personal branding and oversharing in the name of authenticity. And they're sharing too much information. It's sort of like they're selling their struggles rather than an actual solution. An example of this would be if you've ever scrolled through Facebook and somebody posts a picture of their nasty open wound on their big toe. Like, that's gross. Nobody wants to see that. You'll get eyeballs, you'll get shock value, and then you'll lose people. People will block you because nobody wants to go about their day while they're waiting online at Starbucks for coffee and see your nasty big toe, you know? And that's, of course, just symbolic, but I've seen people do that. And so what I advocate for is a third way, which is to just become the person that you are actually trying to sell to people. Become somebody that people want to work with and be around. One of the questions that I present as a litmus test is to ask yourself, can I build a campfire around what I'm sharing? And by what I mean by that is it warm? Is it inviting? Is it something that you can build a community around? Are you somebody who people want to be around? Neil, you know this from your practice. A lot of times prospects choose an attorney based on how that attorney makes them feel. Right. Do they feel safe? Are they angry and the attorney will calm them down and just give them a clear path forward? Or are they going to agitate you? I'm going off on a little tangent here, but it's especially relevant for your audience. About 5 years ago, when you and I met, I was on the front end of going through a divorce.
Yeah.
It was a very painful time in my life. And we were trying to work through it at the time that we were there, you know, whether it was 2016 or 17 or whatnot. I think it was 2017. And I remember looking for an attorney in New Jersey, which is where I lived. And I was like, I don't want to go window shopping. Just, can I just find the right person to help me through this? And I went to this, I found this high powered family law attorney, you know, with this big firm here in the capital of Bergen County in New Jersey. And dude, this lady was like ice. She was like ready to kill. She's like, we're going to do this. I was like, look, I don't want anything hostile. You know, I don't want to kill her or anything like that, but you know, clearly this isn't working out and I just want it to be amicable. No, we gotta get the guns ready. She's going to come after you. She's going to come after all the stuff you have. And then there's this other guy I met and he was like, oh, he was very calm and he just kind, and he just kind of made me feel at ease. And it was his personality, not his expertise. I mean, he was good at what he did. He had great reviews, but it's how I felt. And that was so important.
You know, when you talk about those two different camps of people and how they present themselves, particularly on social media platforms these days, I mean, I think that really resonates. Maybe the renting the mansion and pretending to be somebody you're not, maybe that not so much for attorneys, because we always have those ethical issues that we have to keep in mind. But the oversharing part, the other end of the spectrum, is absolutely true. And, you know, there's a fine balance between being open and human and, as you said, oversharing. So how can we kind of guard against that? You know, are there some processes or tools or procedures that we can look to help rein that in and keep it in the space that you're looking for, the campfire feeling that you're looking for?
Yeah, I feel like there's a distinction. I draw a distinction, at least, between authenticity and transparency. And let me elaborate by this. Authenticity could mean I'm really feeling lousy today. I'm struggling. I am really busy at work, but I'm hanging on, right? And this is one takeaway that I've learned to help me in this really busy season. And I'm trying to be helpful there. Right? I'm trying to add value to people. Transparency is, let me tell you what my blanky blank of an ex-wife is doing. But you know, it's like, nobody needs to know that, right? Mm-hmm. And now a lot of my life is online. I've built this brand, quote unquote, online, this identity over the years. And I was like, I can try to hide that I'm going through a divorce. People are going to find out, because they're like, how come Iris isn't in your pictures anymore? They're going to know.
Yeah.
Right. So I remember recording, you know, back at that time, a podcast interview. I said, hey, look, I'm going through some stuff right now that I'm not at liberty to talk about. It's really hard. I'm having a difficult time. But these are some tips my friends shared with me to help me through this time. And what I'm doing there is I'm being authentic about how I'm feeling. I'm not pretending like everything is, you know, sunset and rainbows. I am acknowledging that I'm having a hard time, but I'm also trying to be helpful in it. And what happened was people resonated with that. And they were like, we don't know what's going on with you, but, you know, we're sending our love. And thank you for actually sharing these tips. These were really, really helpful. There's a way that you can do that. Very few people in my life have the right to know everything.
Right.
That right should be reserved for very few people. And in light of that, that also means when people give you a hard time online, don't take it personally, because they're not even in like your inner circle. There are a whole host of people that just see me as a character on the internet and say what they want, and they don't have the right for me to be personally offended by them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it goes both ways. And that's kind of how I safeguard myself.
And I think there are times when we as attorneys, and I'll give the example on Facebook, we want to be open and share our personal lives and our professional lives, because, you know, that's who we are. I mean, particularly as a solo or a small firm practitioner. But I think the balance tilts and shifts when, for instance, your personal account, you know, starts becoming inundated with professional, you know, scripting, whether it be posting your blog posts and oversharing about clients or your work environment. When all you say on your personal Facebook or your personal social platforms is about your business, well, people, I think, see through that, and you're losing that authenticity. It's clear that you're using those personal platforms for professional, you know, propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one thing that's interesting, and I think that law is unique in this respect. You have a client, right? And they've hired you and they're feeling the effects of whatever issue they're dealing with, you know, 24/7, they're losing sleep over it. And they're connected with you on Facebook. Somehow they find you and they see you, you know, I don't know, out to dinner at a restaurant or something. Right. This is totally not fair, but this is exactly what they think. They're like, oh my gosh, Neil's not doing anything. I knew he's not, he's slacking off. He's eating dinner. How dare he eat dinner while I'm dealing with this divorce or this, you know, lawsuit or something. Right. And so I think you guys are very, very unique in that regard. I think what I would do if I were in law and had active clients all the time who had 24/7 issues, I would post things on social media about my personal life enough to, you know, kind of maintain that human connection, but I would date them. I would like retroactively post them. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is I just had a great dinner 2 weeks ago. We had a great dinner here 2 weeks ago, you know, at this such and such restaurant in New Orleans. That's what I would do. Yeah. And it just kind of keeps that emotion out of it. Like there have been some, where this all stems from is many, many years ago, I hired this designer to build a website for me and he totally ghosted me. Like he would not answer my emails. Mm. What did I do? I started being weird. I was like, let me check him out on social media.
You started stalking him.
Yeah. Yeah. I started stalking him. I was like, what is he? I'm seeing him tweet. I'm like, oh, he has got enough time to tweet, but not build my website, which I already paid for. You know, and it's just this weird thing that people get into. Yeah.
Yes. That dynamic. I, on the other hand, you know, I do social media advertising for my law firm, as do many solo practitioners. And I have taken to using family photos as part of my ads consciously, because it shows me in that environment. It shows to my clients what's important to me, and hopefully they can relate on that level. Those are the kinds of people that I want to work with. So it's a double-edged sword. You just have to be careful not to overdo it. And in that sense, you know, trying to figure out the clarity or to get some clarity about how to brand yourself, I think is the hardest challenge that we have when we think of our personal beings as our brand. And do you have some advice on what the process in order to trying to achieve clarity as to what my brand ought to be?
Yeah. One of the things I often use are a series of three questions. I just call them the personal brand three. The questions are, number one, what pisses you off? Number two, what breaks your heart? And number three, what's the big problem you're trying to solve? And what I do with the answers to these questions is I help my clients form stories. And likewise, there are three stories that all of us need to be able to tell. Number one is the founder's story. Number two is the business story. And number three is the client story. The founder's story is why you got into law. Like, why did that even interest you? What pissed you off and broke your heart in the world that compelled you to go down this path? Yeah. And there is always something. There is always something. And that's unique to you. It makes you copy-proof. It makes you unique in the market. Your business story is what's the big problem you're trying to solve and when did you start solving it? It's very simple. We started, you know, my law firm and, you know, my law practice on this day, in this year, in this city, right? And then the client story is a story of transformation. What I've found is most attorneys are really good at the business story and the client story, but they're not so great at the founder story. But that's what gives context for everything you do. One client of mine, and I've worked with him since, Stephen Thrasher, who's an intellectual property attorney out of Dallas, he helps me with all my content, online courses, my book, you know, speeches, everything. And years ago, when he came to one of my seminars, we were working through this, you know, what pisses you off, breaks your heart, what's the big problem you're trying to solve? And of course, he gave me, Neil, the classic attorney answer. You know, just really, you know, the problem I'm trying to solve is to help creators protect their intellectual property. And after some digging, we unearthed the fact that he had earlier in his life, he's an entrepreneur, he runs a bunch of different businesses, had his business stolen from him because he didn't rightfully trademark and protect all of his assets. He had a business partner he thought he could trust. And so they just kind of operated on faith. And I said, if you have the guts, this is the story you need to put on your website. And if you put it on your website, you will get a lot of business. And he did exactly that because he was able to contextualize why he went into, particularly why he went into intellectual property law and why he cares so much about creators being having their work protected. It is a shining example of how this guy has used his personal brand and his story to differentiate himself in the marketplace and give clarity to the market of who he is and what he does. It's opened up countless stages for him to speak on, podcasts to go on. And it's just a shining example of what makes him different. Now, that doesn't make his story any better than someone else. It doesn't mean that every intellectual property attorney just needs to be have been ripped off at some point in their life, but there's always a thread. There's always a thread. We can look at some other attorney who just as well might be an intellectual property attorney. And I will say, what pisses you off about this? Where is this? And it might be something completely unrelated to intellectual property law, but it will be about injustice that he sees in the world. So he or she is more of an injustice, you know, person. And that story needs to come out. So yeah, there's always a reason. And we just have to dig and find it.
And their story can be different at different times too. You know, one of the things I think is really great about the practice of law is that you can change practice areas. So, you know, in my own case, when I first started out as an attorney, the things that pissed me off or that gave me joy or that, you know, the clients that I wanted to work with are different than they are now. And so my story has changed. And I think you have to be able to reflect that in your brand. If I still presented my brand the same way I did when I was a litigator, it would not resonate with what I'm doing now as an estate planner.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's something in you as an estate planner, probably tied to family, probably tied to legacy. Yeah. And that's the story we dig at and craft and share. And then it's your job to share it until you get sick of it and then some, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what branding is. It's being consistent with that message over time.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexaclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's five or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com.
One of the challenges I think we find, though, with this whole concept of branding is it's a gigantic ball of yarn to me. You know, there's a lot of intertwined pieces to it, and I feel like I'm always pulling at one stray string of yarn to trying to figure out the process for, you know, developing an approach to branding. I don't ever feel like I have a systemic, you know, way of going about rounding out my brand identity. Can you develop a framework?
Yeah, I think that the way that I look at it, and this is some of the stuff that I talk about in the book, is that when it comes to our brand identity, there are three sub-identities to every brand. And all of these three things need to be aligned. Now, after that, you can play in the sandbox almost whatever way you want. But be intentional about these three things. The first is your visual identity, how you look. I mean, if we get into the nitty-gritty of it, the typeface and fonts you use on your website and marketing materials, the colors that you're using, the photos that you're using, be intentional about that. That should also align with your number two, verbal identity, which is how you talk. What are some of the words that you, what's the tone of voice that you have? Do you sound professional? Are you warm? Are you approachable? Are you academic? Are you just kind of flippant? Are you scary? You know, do you use scare tactics in your marketing and your copy? Mm-hmm. You know, it's that verbal identity. And then that's aligned with number three, your value identity, which is your positioning in the marketplace. Your positioning has everything to do with how you sit or where you sit relative to the competition. If you take a Louis Vuitton, you know, designer handbag ad and put Walmart text on it, discount now, low prices every day, coupons matched, you don't need to be a marketing genius to figure out something's wrong, because there's a misalignment between the value identity, the visual identity, and the verbal identity. So for many of us, whether we're, you know, attorneys, coaches, speakers, you name it, just making sure that those three are aligned gives you really the template to work off of and base everything off of on social media or on podcasts or other content that you create. I'm always looking when I'm working with a business to get those three identities set, because that makes every other platform easier to create for. Too many people work the other way around. They work outside in. So they overpost on Instagram or Twitter or LinkedIn, or like you said, Facebook, all over their own personal feed. And they don't seem aligned. They seem like they're scattered. And it's because they are. They're not working from a playbook.
Yeah, I feel like this is one area where you really need to give serious thought to bringing in professional help. Because me personally, I pick around the edges and I find myself fussing with the color scheme and the fonts and the and all of that and the photos and thinking that that is my brand. That's the essence of branding. And as you just really pointed out, it's just one leg of the three-legged stool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's easy to get caught up in one thing. Most people, when you ask them, what is branding? They'll say it's your look or your logo.
Yeah.
And it really isn't. It's all of these things. Walk into Apple, an Apple store. I know that they're a very old, you know, example of all, everyone uses Apple as an example, but it's because they're on brand. They don't say a lot. They let their visuals do the talking. Their slogans are always two or three words, you know, think different. I mean, what kind of slogan is that for a computer? But their verbal identity matches. Now, if you have someone who is a very verbose and academic, they're going to stick to that identity and that's going to become part of who they are as a brand. Even large companies, Wendy's, for example, the hamburger chain, they're famous for their Twitter account. They have a tone of voice on Twitter that is snarky, that is funny, that has dark humor, that talks like a potty-mouthed teenager, you know, potty-mouthed college student. And it's just part of their brand. They brought in some consultancy or they in-house decided we're going to sound like this. And lo and behold, all these other fast food chains are trying to emulate them. Yeah, they're like, okay, this is what, and people read the Wendy's Twitter account just for fun. But I mean, I'm pretty sure a lot of those people end up going buying Wendy's hamburgers, right? Just by being exposed to them on their Twitter feed all day.
Yeah, possibly. The other challenge that I have, and you know, I put this in personal terms so often because I think I've made all the mistakes that most people are going to make when it comes to branding, is I need to make those connections clear such that the story is consistent across the board. As you said, those three pillars are aligned. But at the same time, I struggle with, you know, how to position the pricing element in that context, because I think, you know, if there's a disconnect there as well, you're going to have some issues. And let me bring that to a specific example. If I'm catering my estate planning practice to middle and lower income families, I can't sell it at, you know, the high net worth value point. And so is there some strategies to kind of align that pricing philosophy or how you go about positioning yourself in the market in that respect?
One of the things that I found helpful, and you know, this will probably require a little bit of creativity, especially because we're talking about a service, you know, in your case, Neil, that you offer that is probably consistently priced across the board, right? You may not be able to price different clients at different amounts. You may or you may not. Yeah. But one of the things that I talk about in the book, and it's in the chapter on pricing, is a 9-box grid that I use to price all of my projects. And along the left side of this grid are the three tiers, right? Three rows, 3x3, on my level of involvement in the project.
Okay.
So at the lower left, it might be, you know, the lowest level of involvement, you know, the middle row might be my regular level of involvement, and the top will be, you know, I'm basically doing the whole thing. The analogy that I use for that row, those rows to my clients are, well, there's an option where I drive the car and you sit shotgun. I'll basically do everything. Mm-hmm. The second tier is you drive the car and I'll sit shotgun and I'll just advise you. And the third is you drive the car and I'll sit in the back seat. Now, those are three different levels of engagement. And then across the top of the 3x3 box, I have the least amount of money that I'll do all of those three things for. I'll have the regular amount of money that I'll do all three of those things for. And then I will have a windfall amount that I will do all of those three things for. And it's really important to set a windfall amount, because if you never set the intention of a windfall amount, you'll never win a windfall engagement. And what you'll find is when you start to price these things out, you'll notice some pretty large discrepancies in how you're pricing these different things. For me as a consultant, there are times where I know this project is going to be a headache because this client is already a lot to deal with.
All right.
And I will say, okay, I'm going to give you my, you know, medium level of engagement, but I'm just going to charge this person a windfall amount. And if they don't take it, no big deal, because it's just not going to be worth it to do it the regular amount. And you start to see these discrepancies everywhere. And, you know, in an industry like yours, where the hourly rate still plays a big role, a lot of folks will ask me, because I'm a little bit more in this wild west of pricing where, you know, people are like, how much should I charge per hour? I'm not always sure everybody should charge per hour. I understand that in some industries you have to do that. But what I ask them is what I call the traffic from hell principle. You know, if you had to drive across the George Washington Bridge into New York City to, you know, 30 minutes of the worst traffic and pick up a check from me and then drive 30 minutes back, how much would that check have to be? $500, you know, $1,000, $50.
And to make it worth that while.
Yeah, to make it worth the while. And the reason I do that is because psychologically, here's how most of us price ourselves. What is the most amount of money I can make without losing the contract?
Yeah.
And therefore, what's the least amount that I would do this for? And that's just kind of my starting point, that traffic from out, you know, from hell principle. And then I load that into the 9-box grid and I just start to work from there. And then I can get flexible, because I don't charge a $200 project hourly. That's just going to be, you know, too much money for most people. But this grid and visualizing it can help me get a better handle on how I'm pricing things.
Yeah. When I saw that in the book, I kind of adapted it in my mind to think, well, maybe it's not always, you know, the columns might not always line up with actual rates, but could line up with pricing approaches. So on the one hand, I might do something on an hourly basis. Another time, I might do something on a fixed fee basis. In another column, I might do it on a subscription basis. Mm-hmm. So you still have the differentiation that you suggest in your grid, but it's kind of a different way of looking at it.
I love that. I love that. It's a great adaptation.
Yeah. You know, and the other challenge that we as professional services companies, legal specifically, have, and that has really been stressed over these last few months, you know, the pandemic, and actually it's going to be last few couple years now, unfortunately, is that historically law has been built on the basis of relationships. And in the past, cultivating those relationships really involved your lunch schedule and your happy hour schedule, and maybe a few bar association meetings afterwards. It's much more difficult now, particularly with those things not taking place the way they used to. And frankly, that's not the way we like to build relationships so much. So what would be some of your suggestions in terms of building that connection with other people so as to, you know, grow your practice and foster your business?
Well, I think you're doing a great job of that with the podcasts. You have to create content. I mean, it's par for the course now. This is not in the book, but this is because it would have just confused people for the scope of the book. But one of the things I do is I draw a graph, you know, another diagram for people. And I say, on one side, you have a lot of followers, and on the other side, you have, you know, a lot of expertise and authority. So if you are someone who has very little expertise and very little, you know, small following, you got no worries. You're an industry insider. This is, you know, this is like your law clerk, right? Mm-hmm. For most of us, we are on the side of the grid where we have a lot of expertise with very few followers. We have very little audience. And we are experts. I call us experts. And how do experts typically market? Word of mouth.
Right? Yeah. Now, historically, that's been the case for law, yeah, for sure.
Exactly. And then we look at, well, Mike, what about the people who have a lot of followers and a lot of authority? Well, we call those folks thought leaders, right? They're like kind of like the famous people in all of our industries. But how do they market? They often market through a framework. They market through a certain methodology, right? They're known for a particular way of doing things. Now, what about that other quadrant there where you have a lot of followers, but very little expertise? And I'm going to just use this term. I don't mean to deride anyone, but no, modern day, we call them influencers.
Yeah.
Right? These are like the
Paris. I thought you were going to say Kardashian.
Well, I was just going to say that. When I was growing up, it was Paris Hilton. Yeah. In this generation, it's the Kardashians. Exactly. It's like, what are they known for? But being known. They're just famous for being famous. What do they actually know? Now, here's the one thing that we can take out of their page, their playbook. The one thing that these people, the Kardashians, the Paris Hiltons, the influencers of the world on YouTube and Instagram and you name it, they publish. That's how they make their money. They never miss a blog post. They never miss an Instagram post. They never miss a YouTube video, because if they don't publish it, they will not get the ad revenue. So these are full-time content creators. And this is what I stumbled into when I started my business. I was an expert. I was a good copywriter. I was the CMO of a company. I had expertise. Nobody knew who I was. And I just figured, you know, while I'm working at this job, I'm going to start blogging and launch a podcast. And I sort of delved into that influencer space where people were getting to meet me and build relationships with me in a passive way.
Yeah.
I would say marketing isn't about closing a sale. It's about opening a relationship. And having that content out there allowed me to do that. Then once I published the book and I had a framework, I was able to step into the thought leadership space. People understood what kind of methods I used. I think for lawyers, for attorneys, this is especially important because you guys deal with very, very serious issues for people. And people, when they deal with serious issues, need the ability to interact with you at their own pace and in their own space. What I mean by that is, look, when I was going through my divorce, I didn't join a divorce coaching group. My God, it was too personal. I read a bunch of books privately in my room, staring at the screen, you know, the ceiling all night, wondering what the hell is happening to my life. I watched a bunch of YouTube videos on it. And I got to know these people who were talking about this stuff and helping me through. I felt like some of the books I read, like if I ever meet the authors, I'm like, thank you for being with me. You don't know who I am, but you were with me in some of the darkest, loneliest times of my life. And that's what you want content to do for you. I've built a relationship with these folks because they allowed me to interact with them at my own pace and in my own space. Now I feel like they're trusted friends almost. And I was shocked, Neil, when I was going through that process, I would just try to Google family attorney law, New Jersey. No content anywhere. Some of the most helpful blog posts I found were attorneys from Georgia, Texas. Yeah. I was like, too bad I can't hire them. I'd hire them right now because this is such good content. Nobody in New Jersey was doing it.
And that was in those days. It's even more prevalent now. People are really, you know, they do their research and they want to read what you have to say. They want to get to know, you know, who you are. They want to start that relationship passively to the point where, you know, the first time they actually speak to you, they've got a whole list of questions and they feel like they already know you. Mm-hmm.
There's such a big difference between active impact and passive impact. And content is exactly what allows you to do that. You know, we want to go to a networking event. We've got to get dressed up. We've got to hop into the car or the Uber. We've got to carve time out. That's all active work. But you publish the post once and it sits on your site and people can read it whenever they want. And they come across your website and read the articles. You're having passive impact while you're out to dinner with your family or your kids or, you know, taking the day off.
Certainly can be a lot more efficient in that respect.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, I'm going to wrap up here with just a little quick story and another encouragement for our readers to our listeners to go out and get the book. You Are the Brand, the 8-step blueprint to showcase your unique expertise and build a highly profitable, personally fulfilling business. This is by Mike Kim. You can find it anywhere that quality books are sold. And I'm going to tell this little quick story. I mentioned in the beginning that Mike and I met at Ernie Svensson's boot camp event in New Orleans. And Mike gave a presentation on how to write effective emails. And I took notes because it just really resonated with me. And I reduced the essence of it to a 2x2 yellow sticky that I stuck on the edge of my computer screen. And that note literally stayed attached to my screen until it finally fell off some 5 years later. And I had to then commit it to a digital copy so that I would never lose Mike's email structure of character, problem, guide, plan, call to action, success, and failure. That's the principles of his email structure. And I've used that to structure specific emails to my mailing list and email campaigns to my email drip campaign subscribers. And so I suggest to our listeners, if something as profound as email structure can sit with me for these 5 years and have such a profound effect on what I do, imagine what an entire book of this wisdom could do for you. So I really do urge you to go out and get Mike's book. I think you'll find it to be a fascinating read. And I can't be more happy to have you, Mike, on the podcast. And thank you for your time. You've been very, very generous. And I wish you just great success.
Well, thank you, Neil, for having me. I'm so glad we reconnected and ran into each other at Cadre in DC. And here we all are. And I just hope that today's conversation was helpful for all of you who are tuning in.
Thanks so very much, Mike, and carry on with the good work. Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.